On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A week of flux in Washington and maybe Baghdad. Outcomes unclear. The president's urge to surge, getting a cold response on many fronts, but no clear move to stop it yet. House Democrats celebrating their 100-hour agenda success, but the Senate and White House veto threats remain, as do much bigger fish than the minimum wage, like Social Security and Medicare, says Fed Chief Ben Bernanke. In Iraq, Prime Minister Maliki says he wants more guns, not more Americans, but militiaman al-Sadr. Sadr's top aide has reportedly been arrested. Warrantless wiretapping is over, sort of, maybe. And China flexes military muscle in space. Up next on Point, our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. We have a great panel with us today. With me in the studio, David Gergen, advisor to Presidents Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton. He's now director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and editor-at-large for U.S. News and World Report. David Gergen, great to have you right here.
Thank you.
With us from Philadelphia is Trudy Rubin. She's foreign affairs columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. Trudy, welcome back. Good to have you.
Nice to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, good to have you there, my friend.
Hello, Tom, David, and Trudy.
David Gergen, dive in with us first. A lot going on this week. No single big speech, but a lot bubbling here. What's got your attention?
There is a lot of ferment in Washington this week. I must say, I thought the Democrats got off to a remarkably good start in the House. You know, the Democrats' conventional wisdom is that they can't organize a two-car funeral. That seems to apply now more to the Maliki government than anybody else. Mm-hmm. But the Democrats got off to a very good, disciplined start in the House, passing all six of the bills that they promised. They're not major league bills, but they are important. And some of them will find their way into law. The minimum wage bill is likely to become law. That's important to lots and lots of Americans, millions of Americans. I think ethics reform has been important. They got it through both the House
and the
Senate.
Squeaked it out in the Senate at the last there, yes.
Well, they got it through with only two dissenting votes, so that was important. And they're going to, I think, get the student loan bill through.
Lower interest rate there.
They're running to a buzz saw from the president on negotiating with pharmaceutical companies over drugs for seniors and over stem cell research. But when you look at the totality of it, two things that emerge. One is, or three things really. One is the Democrats are much more disciplined than they traditionally are. Mm. Secondly, they haven't wandered off into the wilderness on the left. They have shown themselves to be a more – they've responded to this thrust from the middle in the 06
elections. Tacking center there, yep.
Yes. And finally, it's obviously important that they now have the microphone. And they've been able to use these hearings, whether it's the Biden hearings, the Judiciary Committee hearings, or other hearings. They've changed the discourse in our politics so that there's more of an even – there's more of a debate now as opposed to one party really running things.
So something new going on there. Trudy Rubin, Nancy Pelosi says, of course, first female Speaker of the House says, Congress will no longer be a place where optimism and good ideas come to die. Do you see in this first 100-hour agenda and its successful passage in the House, not through the Senate or through the White House yet, but do you see the harbinger of a new day dawning there?
Well, I think one of the things that struck me about the 100 days and these many
hours,
pieces
hours,
of legislation.
Hours,
I mean,
please.
Sorry, 100 hours, excuse me.
Right.
Yes, getting
45,
confused with the past.
Yeah. Okay.
Right, 100 hours. Was how much more publicity that legislation would have gotten if the headlines hadn't been taken up by various Democrats striding to the PR podium to talk about Iraq. And I thought that it was under-publicized. I certainly agree that there is going to be a much more a much stronger Democratic presence. It's going to be much more interesting on the Hill. But it seems to me that Iraq is still going to dominate the headlines because the next couple of months, this issue of the surge and whether or not it fails. And so far, the Democrats' failure to agree on one alternative plan and really, as I see it, a failure to think through what do you do if the surge fails and have a program for that, I think is going to cast a shadow over the domestic side of the political spectrum.
A lot of thunder on that side. Let's listen to a little bit from John Edwards. Of course, John Kerry's VP running mate last time out. He's looking to take the presidency again. Really challenging Democrats this week in the speech on Martin Luther King Day to stop the president from sending more troops to Iraq.
If you're in Congress and you know that this war is going in the wrong direction, and you know that we should not escalate this war in Iraq, it is no longer okay to study your options and keep your own private counsel. Silence is betrayal. Speak out and stop this escalation now. You have the power, members of Congress, to prohibit this president from spending any money to escalate this war. Use that power. Use it now. Do not allow this president to make another mistake and escalate this war in Iraq.
There's the voice of challenge from John Edwards. Trudy Rubin, you wrote recently that the surge isn't even a surge. When you really look at the numbers, it's barely a bump in the troop presence there. What do you see going on in the headlines coming out of Baghdad this week? Maliki kind of back and forth, sort of saying we want guns, not more Americans. But then we hear of this arrest of Atape to Muqtada al-Sadr. Are the winds turning in Baghdad? Do you see a holding pattern? What?
Well, I've written that the surge is a trickle, and I think it's really important that Americans understand there is more fuss being made over this than it deserves in terms of escalation. I don't think this surge can work because it depends on what you mentioned in Baghdad. It depends really on the political abilities of the Iraqi government to come up with some kind of reconciliation plan, because in reality, this surge is just in the next couple of months, at most 7,000 additional troops in Baghdad. The new counterinsurgency manual that the Army has just put out that was supervised by General Dave Petraeus.
Who's moving into command there. Yep.
Exactly, moving into command there. If you use their calculations, you'd need 120,000 combat troops in Baghdad. The difference is going to be made up by Iraqis who we know have not been reliable in the past, and there's only going to be 9,000 new Iraqis. They're Kurds.
But is something new going on? What about this headline, Trudy, that Atape to al-Sadr is arrested, and not mildly, a bodyguard shot in the process, Muqtada al-Sadr, the Shiite leader himself, saying 400 of his men have been arrested in a crackdown recently. Is something changing there, even if it's a trickle?
Last week already, there was word coming out of Baghdad that Muqtada al-Sadr had told his people to lay low. I think the strategy of the Shiite militias is just going to be to keep their heads down while hopefully whatever new troops, American troops and Kurdish troops, Iraqis from the north come in, will concentrate on Sunnis. The arrest of Mr. Daraji, who was Muqtada's public relations man, although in the background he has a bigger role than that. We don't know yet whether it's only symbolic, whether he will be kept in prison, or what this means in the long run. Because as Secretary Gates said, and he's out in the region now, he estimated that the surge would only last a few months. And in fact, if the Iraqi government doesn't come up with a political plan, doesn't live up to its promises, the rest of the surge after the 7,000 infusion may not even happen. So when the surge is over, Muqtada's people can just come out of the woodwork.
Jack Beatty, what's caught your eye this week, my friend?
Well, just to get back to the legislative agenda, what I'm struck with, and I wonder what David thinks about this, is the emerging center here, the Republican votes for these measures. 68 for the committee to the bill to adopt the September 11th commission recommendations, 82 Republicans on the minimum wage, 37 Republicans on stem cell research, 24 on prescription drugs, 124 on student loans, and even 36 on energy policy. And then, of course, in the Senate, we have Chuck Hagel sponsoring a resolution with two Democratic senators. We have talk there of more Republicans joining with Democrats. There seems to be a new center emerging, sort of in both parties. What do you think about that, David?
David Gergen.
That's a very interesting point. I think Jack is absolutely right. We thought after the elections that many of the moderates in the Republican Party had been purged. They'd gone down. Those are the ones who went down, and there was a sense that maybe the Republican Party really would become even more conservative in the Congress. And I think Jack is right to point out that there seem to be a lot of Republicans who got the message from this election that the middle wanted to be heard for a change. They were tired of all of the ends of the spectrum bickering with each other. And so they're responding. I think there's a real fear in the Republican Party about 08.
The president out and about talking this week, sometimes intimately, saying here on the PBS NewsHour that he was unhappy with the way the execution of Saddam Hussein was carried out by the Iraqis.
It sent a mixed signal to the American people and the people around the world. And it just goes to show that this is a government that's still got some maturation to do.
Some maturation to do. President Bush said he anticipated some of the negative reaction to his plan of a troop surge in that same interview.
I'm not surprised that people are saying, okay, you may think this is necessary for success, but we're skeptical. And so we're in a period of there's some pessimism and some skepticism here in Washington that I'm going to have to continue to work through.
Some pessimism, some skepticism, and some confusion. David Gergen, I have to admit, I'm confused. Where does this leave us if the president hits the headwinds he's talking about on the surge? Trudy Rubin says it's not even a surge, it's a trickle. Democrats and some Republicans say we don't want to do it. Well, what happens out of all this? What actually happens?
We move forward with more troops there. They may be small. I think it's too little, too late. Politically here at home, I do think the Democrats are coming together with some Republicans. It's not only Chuck Hagel, Olympia Snowe, and others. There are probably 8 and maybe as many as 12 Republican senators who will join in a resolution opposing this so-called surge.
Does the resolution make a difference?
It's symbolically very important, and if the president loses the resolution loses 8, 10, 12 Republicans, yes, that's very important. It really demonstrates to the world and to him he does not have the foundational support at home he needs to prosecute the war. It weakens his hand overseas. It weakens his hand in Iraq. But let's contrast it, after all, with what happened at the beginning of this war when the Senate approved a measure giving him the authority to go in, and how they had to live with that for so many years, and how difficult that has been for them since. So to put themselves down firmly on the other side along with Republicans will make a difference, at least in the political landscape here at home. Puts the president on even more treacherous ground at home. But to go back to what Trudy is really right to point to, what is going to happen on the ground? I think the indications from Baghdad right now are very mixed. What has been, I think, a little encouraging, there are some signs from Iran that there are pressures building up within the country itself to slow down on the nuclear front.
A rebuke in a paper tied to a top clerics there saying, Ahmadinejad, get out of the nuclear stuff. Just stand back.
Because the larger fear over the last few days has been not just that Iraq would continue to be the spiral downward, but that this administration might actually get us into a confrontation with Iran before the president leaves office, moving a second carrier into the area, flexing our muscles.
Do you think Iran is responding to that? Is Iran intimidated here?
Well, there are some indications. I'd be interested in Trudy's view on this, but there are some indications that the passage of the UN sanctions, the pressure, is actually meeting with some positive response among some elements in the Iranian society who do not want to be isolated, and that some things may start to move in a more positive direction. But, Trudy, I stand to be corrected by you.
What do you think, Trudy?
No, I think one has to always be very cautious in interpreting Iranian politics, but I think there is an opportunity here. And the fascinating thing to me is while Congress can pressure in a bipartisan way, even with, as you say, 8, maybe more Republicans, on the surge issue, it's very hard to force an administration to undertake a diplomatic initiative. Chuck Hagel has brought up the Iraq Study Group, which calls for a regional conference on Iraq, which I believe is extremely important at some point. But so far, the president has seemed adamantly against that. Condoleezza Rice has used strong language. They know what they need to do, meaning Iran, and saying there has to be a freeze on uranium enrichment before we would talk. It interests me that Secretary Gates Gates has used much more open language, saying that right now there might be nothing to, that Iran wants from us, and so it's not the time to talk now. But indeed, there could be an opening. If the administration had a policy where they were using this buildup not as a prelude to military action, but basically to show that we still have strength and could use it, but if Iran behaves differently, is willing to talk openly, the moment may come for talks, and that's where the internal struggle in Iran is going on. President Ahmadinejad was never the main foreign policy maker. That is a mistake that many in the outside world made. When I was there in May, it was clear that many hardliners even, and I talked to senior people in the Revolutionary Guards, were discontented with him. It's not that they have a warm, fuzzy outlook on the world or the U.S. or Israel, but they did not like his behavior. He's also failing badly on economics, and this new resolution at the U.N. has disturbed many people, and they feel Ahmadinejad's behavior helped bring it about. So the question is, if Iran sees that the course that it is going on, and the supreme leader has let Ahmadinejad fulminate, he is, in the end, the supreme policymaker. If he decides to rein him in, is there then an opening where there could be some progress made in regional talks on Iraq, where we do have some common interests with Iraq, even if there isn't immediate progress on the nuclear issue?
Jack, let me listen here for just a moment. We've got Iraq and Iran cheek by jowl there, politics at home, challenges, maybe room for diplomacy abroad. Republican Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, another presidential hopeful, conservative, speaking on the Senate floor this week, talking about the administration getting more personally involved in solving the factional conflicts in Iraq.
I recommend that Secretary Rice and Vice President Cheney go to Iraq and practice shuttle diplomacy. They should lay the groundwork for a meeting of leaders from all three major Iraqi groups to take place outside of Iraq. This kind of a meeting could be similar to the Dayton Accords that helped resolve the conflict in Bosnia.
More flux. Republicans there. Sam Brownback, Jack, talking about a Dayton Accords diplomacy in the air. But as Trudy says, they can't force diplomacy. That's in the president's hands.
It is, and especially with Iran, you know, with this possible opening, what could close it immediately would be an effort to confront Iran. That would play the nationalist card, which is exactly what the hardliners want. So there's a kind of, scary mutuality of interest, it seems to me, between hardliners in Iran and our hardliners. The hardliners there need the confrontation to cement themselves, and the and our hardliners need it, I suppose, to somehow escape from the Iraq dilemma by creating an even larger Iranian one. But you know, on Iraq, I often don't read the stories about the attacks. I just, you know, I with Thomas Jefferson on slavery, I think that if there's a, I wind up thinking if there's a just God, woe to America when I read them. But I read one last week about this attack at a largely Shiite university, a bombing,
Baghdad,
70 dead, 180 wounded, many 17 and 18-year-old girls. Here is a sentence from the McClatchy newspaper report. One man searched for his son and finally found his head and torso, but no legs. Where is the other half, he asked, and then shook with violent sobs. You know, you read that and you say, what do we owe these people? We can't give them protection. That's just so clear now. It seems to me the least we owe them, and something we need to think about, is refugee status. Those of them who've thrown in with us, we have an obligation to protect. And yet this week we learned in a Senate hearing that we have 20,000 open slots for refugees, and last year we took fewer than 500 Iraqis in. And as this crisis worsens, either after the surge or before the surge, and more of these refugees are forced over the border, it's going to be incumbent upon us, it seems to me, to step up and give shelter to the Iraqis who sided with us. This could be thousands and thousands, but morally, it seems to me, we owe them that.
Something there, but on the other hand, couldn't Iraqis stay in the country at least as long as American soldiers are putting their necks on the line there? Let's begin to turn to our listeners. Saranac Lake, New York, David's calling. Hi, David, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to just comment that I think that we really should be leaving as early as possible from Iraq. But I will tell you the fact that you presented a couple of clips of Senator Edwards, he's caught my attention quite a bit since he announced for president, because I think he had the courage to admit he made a mistake on Iraq. Let me just posit it like this, and this with someone like David Gergen, who I know is a very reasoned and fair-minded voice, even if I don't always agree with you. I've always been influenced by what you had to say in programs such as this, David. I was going to say, I keep thinking that this is sort of like President Johnson with the Vietnam War. We are actually approaching 1967 and 1968, and we're seeing it in this case. Obviously, we're looking for a Robert Kennedy here in our own party to challenge the war thinking, but that's what we're hoping for, and that the number of casualties is far being underreported. Dennis Kucinich of Ohio brought up some facts in this.
Whose casualties? Civilian casualties? The UN this week saying 34,000 Iraqis last year. Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, it would be very difficult to give you a lot of figures over the air because it will confuse everyone. But 650,000 Iraqi civilians ostensibly have died since the occupation as of this last summer.
That's one number
that
out there. We have to.
Very questionable.
I understand.
Yeah. But David, you're saying you're hearing John Edwards step up now and wondering what that says about the politics, I guess. David?
I think so. I think we're seeing a major shift in all areas of our country. I mean, John Edwards, up until a few months ago, was at least supporting mildly our approach over there. Now he has changed his position, and he is saying he made a mistake in his original assessment of it.
Let me take this parallel, this comparison you make, David, to David Gergen on Johnson and Vietnam, Bush and Iraq. That's in the air these days, David Gergen. What do you think of the parallel?
It's an apt comparison. There's no question that here in this Iraq war, after some 4 years now, the center of gravity in politics in our country has shifted from mildly support the president, let's see this through, to this is outrageous. People have turned from disillusionment to anger. What we lack, of course, is a draft that puts young people out in the streets, so we don't have the kind of demonstrations that we had in 67 and 68. But there is the real surge is among people flocking to both John Edwards and to Barack Obama, whether it's Edwards in the case of the anti-war or Obama representing some sense of new hope, new chapter, new way of going about things. You know, being black, and the very fact he's black represents a signal of change.
Could I say something
sure.
about the comparison?
Sure.
The comparison actually disturbs me deeply because although there is apt reason for the comparison in domestic politics, I think that one really has to think about the consequences of Iraq, and I think that they will be very different from Vietnam. Of course, Vietnam, we can look back. We left the area. The dominoes, Laos, Cambodia, but it did not really impact us enormously. This is a country where we entered an optional war, which is in the Middle East, which is in an area from which terrorists come, and in the middle of the oil fields. And I really do believe that if we are going to leave, we have to think about the aftermath. And there is an obvious push now, an emotional push to get out, but there isn't the clear thinking, except from a few senators, you hear this from Hagel, from Biden, there isn't the clear thinking about what do we do afterwards. The Saudi ambassador, who's now leaving, who is a very intelligent man, once said, "You went in uninvited. Please don't leave uninvited." What he meant was the region didn't want us to go in, but if we go out, suddenly it's going to precipitate as much additional chaos as our going in did.
David?
And so there has to be very serious thinking about the consequences, and that's why I say it's really a shame that the Senate isn't able to precipitate the kind of diplomacy that Hagel and Biden are talking about.
And you don't like the Vietnam parallel, but we've still got two presidents with failing wars on their hands, struggling to see what to do.
I agree. Listen, I think Trudy is absolutely right about the need for diplomacy. The very fact we're talking about Iran in a somewhat different way today than we might have 3 weeks ago suggests that the Baker-Hamilton Commission was right, that we ought to be talking to Iran and Syria. I do not believe we're going to pull out precipitously. This president will not allow that. He's not going to be forced
and the
by
next
the Congress.
President?
I think it's going to be on the plate of the next president, and we're going to leave behind a residue of troops for some time to come because there are oil fields there in part. And the real issue, though, becomes how do we minimize the damage to the region? How do we stabilize the region and it, as a whole? And on that issue, the Bush administration has not spoken clearly, nor have the Democrats in Congress. It is a crying need to really have a strategy for the region.
Let me go to Nat in Silver Spring, Maryland. Nat, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. I wanted to ask David Gergen to comment, please, on our role in Iraq, the invasion of the Iranian consulate.
In Erbil last week, yes.
Regarding international law and politics, regarding embassies and countries' representations. And also, if you would, to comment on our support for Ethiopia with their invasion of Somalia. Is that a state-sponsored terrorism that we are involving? Is it legal?
Nat, we've just got a minute before the break. Let me go to David Gergen. Thanks for your call.
The seizing of the Iranians, let me address that. Trudy might take on the other. The seizing of the Iranians on its face might well have violated international law, but I think all the facts that have come out since, especially the fact that the Iraqi government itself is now cracking down on the Iranians who are coming down. They say we've got to tighten this up. This is a very gray area. I would imagine those Iranians will probably be released here in coming days, quietly.
The four or five who were picked up there.
Maybe one or two will be held.
And Erbil did not have official diplomatic status.
Right.
The Iraqi foreign minister has said that. So technically it was not a violation.
And the Ethiopia piece, Trudy, how's that working out? Ethiopian troops in Somalia, it's gotten quiet this week. Does that look like a successful twist, or we still have to wait and see?
We still have to wait and see. Ethiopians staying on for a long time in Somalia, a Christian nation staying on for a long time in a Muslim, you have to feel the unease of this. Even the Ethiopians want to get out. This is a story that's just beginning.
Some remarkable things in sound this week. Famed scientist Stephen Hawking spoke in London at a news conference about the resetting of the doomsday clock, now 2 minutes closer to midnight, and climate being added in to the scientists' calculations.
We understand the dangers of nuclear weapons and their devastating effects, and we are learning how human activities and technologies are affecting climate systems in ways that may forever change life on Earth.
On a very different front, much more intimate, Rebecca Markham, mother of baby Noah, born from a frozen embryo, saved from Hurricane Katrina's floodwaters, said the new baby is a blessing.
I'm so blessed to have a little miracle baby to take home, and hopefully in some small way, if not for one day, they can forget their troubles and you know, look at life and just realize that there's always light at the end of the tunnel.
And back in Washington, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, saying yesterday at a hearing, this administration does not stand up for its citizens' rights.
In the 32 years since I first came to the Senate, and that was during the era of Watergate and Vietnam, I've never seen a time when our Constitution and fundamental rights as Americans were more threatened, unfortunately, by our own government.
Tom is calling from Minneapolis. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. I just got a couple quick comments.
Yeah.
My first comment is, I think it's kind of interesting that you guys, this panel, they know darn well that the Republicans that are speaking out are the same Republicans who always do. Chuck Hagel, Olympia Snowe, the same six or seven that always do. And you guys know that.
What does that mean, Tom? What does it mean, that the center is the same in the Republican Party that's not moving?
It's not moving at all. These are the same people that speak out. They'll speak out on any position Bush takes. They know that. David Gergen knows that. Chuck Hagel, Olympia Snowe, they're the same ones. But
what's different about this is they're now willing to cast their votes. They have not done that in an official capacity. They didn't oppose this war.
And Brownback is not just the same old.
What do you say, Tom?
Well, Brownback's running for president. He knows
half
that
the
he's
Senate
gotta,
is. It seems
he knows he's got to distance himself from the president. But the other ones, they were looking for the first political opportunity to go against this war that they thought they could politically vote against it. That's just my first comment.
But do you really think, Tom, that the Republican Party is not going to move in response to its loss in November of the Congress, in response to the trouble in Iraq? You think it's going to stay steady as she goes with the president all the way?
No, but I don't think they're moving. This is no different. These seven people have been speaking out against Bush since he's been there. It's no
okay,
different.
And your next point, Tom?
My next point is, I find it kind of interesting that the Democrats, Senator Clinton and Dodd and Biden and a lot of the other ones, Harry Reid, just a couple, less, probably a year ago or maybe even less, they were calling for troop surges. They all, on record, I was listening to Rush Limbaugh yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you guys love him. But he played a clip of them, a montage of all of them speaking out, saying, you know, less than a year ago or maybe a little over a year, that they, most of them called for troop surges. Now they don't want it. It's kind of interesting.
There's a reason for that.
And I should say, Tom, we played some Rush just yesterday in our second hour, so Rush is no stranger here. But, Trudy, what do you say?
No, I mean, the point is that from the very beginning, as General Shinseki predicted, there were not enough troops to provide security in the country of Iraq. And when the issue was a Sunni insurgency, the core of which is not so much concerned with American troops as with a return to power of hardline Sunnis or religious Sunnis, when that was the issue, you needed more troops to try to stabilize areas like Anbar province, because there were a lot of Sunnis who did not want to be ruled by hardline religious fanatics, but they were afraid and they were being assassinated. More troops would have helped in the past. The problem now is we're in the middle of a civil war and there aren't more troops to be had of the kind of numbers that would make a difference.
Let me take a call from Tingsboro, Massachusetts. Faraz is on the line. Hi, Faraz. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
We're well. What do you think, Faraz?
Well, I'm angry. I'm angry because I'm a Muslim and I've lived 25 years of my life in this country, and I'm angry. I'm angry because when this 9/11 first happened, the whole thing was that, you know, we were scared. We're scared as Muslims. We have kids in this country. They're as American as anybody else, apple pie and cake. And we had to explain to them why we had to not view, we couldn't voice our opinions. Why we couldn't be treated as equals, and why everything had changed overnight, even though we'd been here for a good 50 years.
And what's why are you angry now for us? I mean, six years have gone by, and we don't see. I mean, I think there's a fair amount of solidarity with American Muslims. Are you still feeling ostracized?
There isn't. Well, as long as you have Attorney General Gonzalez and locking up 20-year-old boys for basically making stupid statements in California, you do not have solidarity. What you do have is a case of return to World War II, an encampment, virtual encampment of Muslims in this country.
Isn't that a little harsh? I mean, what do you mean by virtual encampment? I mean, we want to hear.
I'll give you an example. My brother, who's a graduate of MIT, had to leave this country after 22 years. He came here when he was 12.
Yeah.
You know why? He couldn't get a job. You know what his profession was? He was a computer engineer, networking, security. Do you know how many jobs are out there? Hundreds. Hundreds. And we know exactly what's going on. The fact is that we've been discriminated against over and over, and you have a bully in the White House. His name, the B doesn't stand for Bush. It stands for bully. And what's happened is this bully's been now challenged, and he's losing. He's basically hoping to grab a straw before he drowns. And what the whole problem here is that the war has been lost. I don't know what you guys are talking about. It's over. It's moderate Muslims like me who are Americans, who understand this country well. And when we go back, we talk about America as one of the best countries in the world. And we tell people, look, understand they're not perfect, but they have done a lot of good things for us. But now what you have is a president who has basically taken away all rights. They can go into your houses. They can listen to your phone calls. They can capture your children, lock them up. Use words like rendition, attrition. You know what rendition is? It's pure torture. That's what we're talking about, and that's what's happening to Muslims in this country. And unless the people of America understand what this is all about, it's not going anywhere. You talk about terrorism. Terrorism doesn't come from a simple case of Osama bin Laden. It comes from things like when you torture people and you continue to torture them for a long period of time, and that's what's happening now. I saw a sting on CNN yesterday. They wrote, instead of Obama, Senator Obama's picture with Osama written underneath it, what message do you think CNN is sending? They're sending a clear message. We don't want a black or a minority president. Make sure you understand. And relating his name to Osama. This
we've got it, and we hear you're on a high tilt there. Jack Beatty, there's a torrent from a Muslim American who's just had it and says Americans aren't watching. Well, we're listening right here, Jack.
We are, but I think we need to look more into what he's saying, not necessarily that there are camps, but that the civil rights violations and the social pressures against Muslim Americans. I've seen stories here and there that have made me feel that these people are being subject to to various pressures, and of course the government with deportations and this rendition he's talking about, of course, in the flagrant case of the Canadian who was sent to Syria by our government to be tortured. That came up in the Senate yesterday, and now apparently in Guantanamo they're trying to draw a legal distinction between torture and coercion. Testimony that emerges from mere coercion, that will be accepted, but not torture. I ask you, where do you draw the line there? I wouldn't want to have to be a moralist to do that. But if I can just get back for a second to the Vietnam thing, here's what worries me about this. The analogy to 1968, the war went on for 5 more years and 20,000 more Americans. That's the part that really bothers me. And yes, sure, if we leave, there's going to be trouble and so on and the rest of it. But no one has shown to my satisfaction that our being there does anything more than create more enemies against us. And if that's the case, then it seems to me the sooner we can leave there with decency, the better for our security interests and the better for the Iraqis as well. I'm terribly afraid of this idea of, well, we've got to scale down and accept that we're going to lose 100 and 200. Why? If it's for nothing, and if it's for worse than nothing.
But Trudy Rubin raises the issue of what next. I want to look home for a minute, though, with our caller for us, David Gergen. What about this issue of civil liberties? Alberto Gonzalez on Capitol Hill yesterday getting a lot of flack from senators on the extra-legal or warrantless wiretapping. The administration now says we'll take these cases to the FISA courts, but they won't explain exactly how or what. Are you confident that this has been brought back within the framework of law as commonly understood, or is it still kind of a renegade policy?
No, I'm not confident. I don't think we can be confident as long as the documents are all sealed and we really can't understand what the agreements have been. What I do believe is that the Congress over the last few years has failed to exercise oversight. It has failed to hold the administration to account. One of the benefits of having divided government is that when the opposition party rules the Congress, you do get better oversight. And I don't think it's any accident that the administration did a U-turn on this question of wiretapping. Had the Republicans been in charge, you would not have seen this U-turn.
Is it a real U-turn?
Well, that's what we don't know. It's full U-turn, but it is something. It is an acknowledgment that the judiciary ought to have a voice in this. But let me go back to this. A couple other things. Listen, the caller, you know, that was harsh and as you say, a lot of vitriol there. But we do need to have conversations in this country to allow people to be heard so we can understand.
Absolutely.
Because there's a lot of identity politics going on right now. If you go into the Jewish community today, and among a lot of people who are active in the Jewish community, there is great fear about anti-Semitism coming back into the mainstream, that these arguments against the so-called Israeli lobby, which, you know,
in this country.
And what Jimmy Carter said about apartheid has gotten a lot of the Jewish leaders upset. There are,
at the same time, Faraz is saying,
yeah,
what about
exactly.
Muslim Americans?
So there is, and you know, unfortunately, I think as long as this administration is in power, that it's going to be very difficult to have reasoned conversations, reasoned discourse in this administration or in this country about a lot of these issues.
Are you equating talking about Israeli influence in the U.S. with anti-Semitism?
No, but I do think that some of the kind of charges that have been flung about echo anti-Semitism. I think it's quite legitimate to talk about Jewish influence, Jewish lobby, or Israeli lobby, as well as other lobbies. There are many, many lobbies in this country. But I think the way it's discussed in some quarters has an anti-Semitic overtone, and I think that's worth coming to grips with. But let's come back to this caller. There are a lot of anti-Muslim things being said in this country. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of anti-Black things being said in this country. You know, so it's a
people are
we
on
have
edge.
A need. Yeah, we're can very I, much on edge because of a losing war.
Trudy.
There was a comment made by Attorney General Gonzalez that I think gets to the heart of what the caller for us said. I don't have the exact quote, but what he said was that one of the reasons the administration didn't feel you could leave these issues up to the judges is that they don't understand anything about Afghanistan. And you could respond to that by saying, yes, but maybe they understand something about the Constitution,
which
the administration has not grasped. One can only hope that now that there is divided government, issues of constitutionality will come up. That's number one. Number two, the Muslim American community is something in this country that is very precious, because unlike in Europe, where many, many Muslim immigrants have just not assimilated for a variety of reasons, in part having to do with the culture of European countries, this is a country where Muslim Americans have had opportunities and have assimilated and have moved up in economics, in professions, and I think it is something that needs to be examined carefully to make sure that that does not stop, because this is exactly the message America wants to give to the world, and if we can't give it with Muslim Americans, then we're really in trouble.
Let me get a call from Jackson, South Carolina. Brenda, you're on the air. Hello, Brenda, are you there?
Call. Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, loud and clear. What do you have, Brenda?
I wanted to agree with the previous caller, and here's why.
This is Faraz, who was upset calling. Yes.
Yes. I'm not a Muslim. I'm a Southern Baptist. But I received an email from a friend in Texas with a link to the American Family Association with a survey, and it said, "This is an extremely important issue. Please take our survey."
And what was it about?
Well, I thought it would be about gays or some, you know, so-called family issue. It was about Muslims, and it started out saying, do you believe any Muslims are good people? Well, I started to take the survey because I wanted to let them know there's somebody who doesn't feel that way. But as I went down the questions, it just got more and more sinister. They were saying, do you really want Muslims running our government? Do you really want Muslims taking over our financial institutions?
So a kind of survey meant to persuade. We take note, Brenda, and we thank you for that report. I want to get one more call, if I may, from Annapolis, Maryland. Nicholas, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks very much. Hello, David, Trudy, Nick Berry. This is a comment about the White House's comment on the Chinese anti-satellite test.
The Chinese knocked down one of their own satellites, but it shows they can do it, and that's a military step in space.
Right. I think we have to pay attention to that. But the U.S. White House, or the White House, said that it believes China's development and testing of such a weapon is inconsistent with the spirit of cooperation that both countries aspire to in the civil space area.
Our time is short. Your take, Nick?
Well, I mean, if my memory serves me, that the U.S. has tested anti-satellite technology, including lasers in space, and that this is sort of symptomatic of the of this administration's "we're number one" kind of posturing.
But take umbrage when somebody else does it. David Gergen, a shot across the bow from China there. Mess with us and your GPS systems could be in trouble.
One of the big questions we face is whether we are acting like the British Empire in its closing days, which the British Empire spent an awful lot of time worried about the Boer War, and meanwhile they didn't keep their eye on America, which came rushing past them industrially. And are we spending a lot of time on, you know, trying to play mayor of Baghdad while China and India are on the rise?
Yeah. Trudy Rubin, what do you say? What does China's anti-satellite weapon bring up in your mind?
What it brings up is that early in the Bush administration, there was a lot of noise in the background about possible programs that would involve weaponization of space. There was a commission that had looked into it in previous years Donald Rumsfeld had been on. And I think that this issue has somewhat gone into abeyance because of all the other concerns in the forefront, like the Iraq War. But it brings to my mind the question of whether you're going to have some kind of international treaty banning the weaponization of space, which this administration has opposed.
Jack Beatty, ready to drop the mantle of mayor of Baghdad, sir?
That's such an apt comparison. The one thing that worries me, David, is what they really had to worry about was Germany.
Yeah, watch out, watch out. David Gergen,
well,
Trudy
said.
Rubin at the Philadelphia Inquirer, Jack Beatty, great to have you all. Thanks for looking back on the headlines of the week. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.